Hey, welcome to this bonus podcast for the Rush Hour with MG, or without MG, as it's been this week. A whole bunch of rotating co-hosts, and the man who came in, opened the batting Monday, Sam Groth, retired Aussie tennis legend. How are you, Sam?
Good, mate. Thanks for having me in here. It's nice to get in here and have a bit of a chat.
Absolutely. Great to have you involved. Thanks for coming on and filling in the MG co-host chair. I'm sorry that you actually had problems with your chair. It didn't quite support your size because you're a massive unit.
I may have put on about 15 kilos since I retired though. So
you hung up the racket after this year's Australian Open, and has it been hard to keep the kilos off?
Well, I haven't really attempted too much, to be honest. It's sort of been nice to have a year, or what's it been now, 9 odd months, where I haven't had to watch what I've had to eat, and you know, been able to have a couple of beers in the fridge. And
is it beers? I was going to say, what's to blame? The beers?
Oh, probably a little bit of everything, to be honest. it's not, because I am quite big. So when I was traveling, I had to be very, very careful, because you know, my optimal playing weight was already about 102 kilos.
Jeez, which is heavy for tennis.
Yeah, which is big. So for me, a couple extra kilos on top of that, it was half a step. So always had to be pretty strict. I did push it occasionally because you can't do it all the time, but it's been nice to have that year where I haven't really had to worry about it. So, yeah.
And what are you doing now? You've 9 months out, aside from the beers, what have you been doing?
It's been nice. It's been sort of a transition year. It's sort of, you know, moved into a house and got a couple of dogs and sort of adjusting to what life in one place looks like, not living out of a suitcase. I think it took me 2 or 3 months to actually get my bags unpacked, which my missus wasn't very happy about. But no, obviously now making a transition, working with Channel 9 over the summer, which I'm excited about. Doing a little bit of stuff with the Herald Sun down in Melbourne, and just a lot of like different little bits and pieces. Playing an awful lot of golf.
Yeah, well, there's no such thing as an awful lot of golf.
Oh well, I played 7 out of 7 days.
That's an awful lot of golf.
Yeah, it's yeah. I think last week I may have got a couple of rounds in a day, and I finished my first round, called my missus and said, I think I'm going to play another one. And all she said was, you've lost it, and hung up on me.
Oh,
so, it's nice. So it's, you know, the things that people, unless you sort of live that sort of lifestyle, sort of hard to explain to people, but it's nice just, you know, being in one place and
not having to plan travel and where you're staying and all the rest of it, and how to get there.
Yeah. And I think also the pressure that, you know, you have to win to survive as well. Now you have to work to survive. But it's just been a nice adjustment.
That's an interesting phrase that most people probably have never had to live with, the idea of winning to survive.
Yeah, well, I think you can do the work. So you're still doing all the work that you have to do. So I think it's, you know, everyone will say they have to work to survive, but we still work, I guess, as tennis players, or did. But if you're not winning, even if you're doing all the work, if you're not winning, you're not getting paid.
What's the leanest it ever got?
When I was 18 or 19, it was, I think I called my parents once and asked that I need some money until Monday, until the paycheck comes through. So I've been pretty good
through most of my career.
But yeah, no, it was, you do things and you'd be pretty smart. I guess I moved to London when I was 18. So as an 18-year-old, you sort of learn pretty quick how to budget your money and deal with a lot of things that most 18-year-olds, well, not most, there's people that do, but you know, especially when you're living in another country and it's your only source of income, you sort of learn pretty quickly how to get by.
Most 18-year-olds stay at home. In fact, most, it's trending towards 30-year-olds who stay at home. The team sport versus individual sport, you know, when football players retire, reunions bring them back together. What's it like as a retired individual athlete?
It's hard, because I think most of my mates, you know, a lot of them are still playing, but because we're on the road all the time, your friendship group's on the road. Everyone then goes back to their home cities or hometowns, or and ends up everywhere. So a lot of my mates are in the States, or you know, from Europe, or the Aussie guys are based in Brisbane or Sydney, or you know, not everyone's really in one place. So it's a strange one, really. It's strange when you sit and think about it, but for me it's not, because it's just the life I've lived. So
You've never known anything different.
No, so my partner Britt, she has all the girls she went to school with, and so she'll catch up with friends, and she might catch up with 10 or 15 girlfriends.
Yeah.
Where I might catch up with a mate or two, because they're the ones that, you know, live where I live and that you're close to. So it's a little bit different, and it's not saying I haven't got any friends, mate.
Did you play those 7 rounds of golf with?
Oh, mate, I've met a lot of people. It's been nice, because now I'm meeting a lot of different people being home as well. So it's good.
You signed up with Channel 9 for the Australian Open coverage starting next year. You've already done a little bit of the commentary, though. You did the Davis Cup tie recently. How'd you find it having to talk about your peers?
Yeah, it's it's good. I mean, obviously, when you move into this side, you're expected to have an opinion. When you play, you sort of try and avoid opinions because you don't want to annoy anyone in the locker room too often.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit different. But, you know, I feel like my knowledge of the game, you know, is pretty good. And I still know all the guys because I've played them all. So I'm recently retired. So I still, you know, what the guys are like in the locker room. And I've played all those sort of top guys.
Have they become a little bit more guarded around you now that they know you're going to be working in the media, now that you're the enemy?
No. And I think that's a good thing, though. I think if you can have a good relationship with those guys as well, they're probably a little bit more willing to open up and you know, hopefully give you a little bit of the side that you maybe don't see. If it's just, not that you don't like journalists, but if you say something around someone you don't know, they're just as likely to write it.
Yeah.
Where I think if someone speaks to me and they say, look, we don't want this, but you can say that, then you can sort of, you know, you understand what they're going through and you know them as a person as well, and I think that's important.
Which is why in any broadcast you bring in former players, because they do have that insight and they have that level of trust. What do you make of the state of tennis at the moment? It feels like as someone, I love the game and have followed it for a long, long time, but it feels like the sport is not in a lull, but it's at a stage where the shadow that is Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer and to a more recent extent, Novak Djokovic, it's just cast over the men's game I'm speaking about here and Serena Williams in the women's game. It's just been dominated by this handful of players for so long and probably since Leighton Hewitt was the last true champion that Australia had.
Well, I think that's the thing with tennis in Australia and just Australian sport in general. I think if you look at most sports in Australia, we demand champions.
Mm.
You know, in Australia, we haven't had one. We haven't had a winner of a Grand Slam since Leighton in 2002 on the men's side.
Was it that long?
Yeah. Jeez, so it's been 16 years. So that's a long time in the men's game. Australia's never gone that long without a Grand Slam champion. So even though we have really good depth of numbers, you know, Alex Diminar's, you know, the number one Australian now has come out of nowhere. Mm. John Millman sits at 33 or 34. Obviously, Nick, you know, fluctuates between 12 and who knows?
100.
I don't think he'll ever blow that far, but obviously, you know, we all demand a lot of Nick and think he could be doing a lot better. Mm. Matt Ebden's had a pretty good year sitting inside, I think he's about 50, but it's been inside the top 50. Bernard Tomic won a tournament last week, who we don't speak about, and hopefully us not talking about him is maybe taking some pressure off and we can actually just let him play tennis for a little while. Jordan Thompson, Jason Kubler's top 100.
So the depth is there.
On the men's side, there's good depth, but I think we all say there's a lull because we haven't got that champion that we've always had, and there's that expectation that we should have. But I think the game has changed a lot over time too, and it's just so happened that, as you said, the game's been heavily dominated by Roger and Rafa and Novak
and
Andy Murray and Stan Wawrinka's won three slams. And
he won three?
Yeah. So So there's this group of guys that's, you know, really, really been the top of the sport for this period of time, and who knows? You know, Roger, you can't think he's got too much longer left. I know he keeps going, but yeah, and Rafa a little bit the same, and Novak's playing well. But at some point, those guys are going to drop away, and then it's up to someone to step up. But you know, our depth's okay. We've just got to, I think, you know, lower our expectations maybe a touch. That you know, we were lucky that for so many years we had absolute champions, and at some point, you know, hopefully that happens again.
Mm. It's and very briefly, not to pay lip service to it, but obviously the women's, Sam Stosur won the US Open and Ash Barty right now and Dasha Gavrilova as well. Where Ash is sitting somewhere in the teens at the moment, I think, with her singles ranking.
And Ash is, I think, about 15. Mm. But I think the same sort of thing. So it's going to take the women's game has had, obviously, Serena being very dominant, but a lot of Grand Slam champions over that last 2 year period. I think there's been, you know, four different champions the last 2 years in a row. So I think the same thing, though. Like, Ash is maturing, and she's obviously had that year away and played cricket, and she's come back unbelievably, but not to add too much pressure, but just let her sort of find her way. And, you know, yes, Ash has the talent and the skills, but it's going to take some time for her to sort of get to that level. And, you know, Dasha, I think she struggled a little bit this year, to be honest. She has some good wins and then just hasn't really taken that step.
It's almost like it's difficult to win a Grand Slam.
Oh, you... yeah, I mean, I never did it, so it must be hard.
What's the furthest you got?
Third round a couple of times. Mm. I was stopped by a guy by the name of Roger Federer at Wimbledon. I reckon if I hadn't run into him that year, I wouldn't have won it, but I think I had a couple more matches left in me.
Right.
It's just, I ran into the best player of all time when I was playing my best tennis, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to get back to some of those names you mentioned earlier in the men's, the Aussie men's side of things. I want to get your thoughts on them. But talking about your Grand Slam career, was Wimbledon your favourite?
Oh, I love playing at home.
Mm.
you know, just the way the Aussie crowd gets behind. If I had to choose somewhere outside of Australia, it'd be Wimbledon. Yeah. I love that whole month, you know, rent a house in London, play Queen's Club, and you know, duck off to maybe Stuttgart for a week and come back. But just that whole, you know, being able to get out of a hotel room and then playing on grass for me.
Yeah.
But playing at home. I mean, even this January, my last ever tournament, I'm playing with Leighton.
And it was a run too. It was a good run.
We started to just believe a little bit, yeah. And I think that was the problem. I played a shocking match in the quarterfinal actually, but that's sort of crowd support. I mean, the second round we beat the guys that won the US Open the previous year, and the crowd was unbelievable. Mm. Like it's like nothing else. And even the guys we lost to, as shattered as they were, you see them 2 days later, and they say the crowd was. Yeah, the crowds in Australia, there's something special, and that's not because I'm Australian. That's just how it is.
Yeah, well, I want to get back to those young Aussies. Alex Dimonor, yeah. 19 years of age, and I think it was at Brisbane a year or two ago where he had that breakout performance, and he won the tournament.
No, Brisbane, Sydney. So he went semifinals in Brisbane, then a final in Sydney the week later.
That's right.
He shot up from sort of 190 in the world this time last year. He's 32 or 33 and pushing being seeded at the Australian Open. And, you know, I think it's he's exceeded my expectations this year. Not that I didn't think he could do this well in the future, but I think straight up he's done a lot better than probably everyone expected. Mm. But it's going to be interesting how he finishes this year. But coming into next year, different expectations again. Mm. You go from being 18, 19 years old, trying to break the top 100 and you're the hunter.
Mm.
Now, all of a sudden, he's going to come around. If he's seeded at the Australian Open, all of a sudden you become the hunted and it's a different pressure then.
And does that become the... that everyone has done their homework on you then, rather than you are this unknown 100-plus ranked player? Everyone knows what your weapons are. Everyone knows where your weaknesses are.
Well, I think it's hard for people to do their homework if they haven't seen you. You know, so they might have seen you play a match previous to playing them. The coach might go out and watch a little bit. But I think now, when Alex turns up to a tournament, everyone's going to know what to expect.
Right.
They're going to know that he's fast. They're going to know that he competes, that, you know, what his strengths and what his weaknesses are. And, you know, because they are still there. And he's still got to improve a lot of things. But also, like I just spoke about, I hope we don't start putting that pressure on him as well. Because, you know, come the Australian summer, it's the 1 month that we get to watch tennis in Australia under a microscope.
Yeah.
And... you know, the way he's going right now, he's going to come in with a lot of added pressure that he hasn't experienced before.
Well, speaking about that, I guess, lowering of expectations, or at least adjusting expectations.
I don't want us to lower and not expect the best from our players, but I think it's just understanding sort of where everyone is at a little bit.
Yeah.
And not just saying, and I use Nick as the example because it happens every single time there's a Grand
Slam.
That's
what I wanted to get to, yeah.
You can ask the question, but every time he comes to a Grand Slam, everyone says, Nick Kyrgios could win this tournament. Mm. That's fine, but at the moment, he hasn't done all the little things that he needs to do that. So maybe let's not just say that. Yes, Nick Kyrgios could win a Grand Slam.
Because he has the talent to.
Yes, but it's more than just talent to win a Grand Slam. Like, talk about the physicality of playing best of five sets at the Australian Open and then having to play best of five sets 7 times in 14 days to win it. That's the difference. So... Nick can come out and beat anyone over best of five sets, but can he back it up? And I'm hoping he's doing the work and that he can.
Mm.
Don't get me wrong. Nothing I say doesn't mean I want these guys to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But I think it's just that understanding that, you know, it takes a lot more than what we probably see when he walks out on court.
Well, and I'm very much a fan of Nick Kyrgios. Yeah, people can pick apart his behaviour at times, but I think the other thing that gets missed is he's 23 or he's 24. He's still a young man who's maturing and growing and figuring out who he wants to be and all the rest of it.
And doing it in the public eye when everyone's scrutinising every move you make.
But let me just present the other side of the argument. The tanking or the quitting on points or seemingly quitting on games, explain that or give me an insight into that from a tennis player's perspective.
I can't because it's not something I ever did. So the reason I retired is because I'd lost... you know, those last few months when I was trying to work up and I was like, I didn't want to do it anymore.
Mm.
So I was like, if I don't want to be out here, I don't want to be tanking and wasting my time. Like,
For a paycheck.
Yeah. I can't understand why Nick does that.
Mm.
But I also don't have the pressure and the expectation that Nick has either. So, yeah, I mean, I can't justify tanking. I mean, I never did it, and I don't think there's any space for it.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think people forget that, you know, it's an individual sport where as much as we all feel like Nick Kyrgios is playing for us, He's playing for himself in an individual sport, and when he comes out and plays Davis Cup or a team event for Australia, you know, we demand that I expect him to give everything because you're playing for more than yourself. The rest of the time, I mean, he's an entertainer. People want to watch him. Every tournament in the world wants him at their every tournament wants him on court at their tournament because he puts bums on seats and people want to watch him. And in the end, it's an entertainment business. Sport is an entertainment business and people want to watch him.
We are singing from the same hymn book, Sam. I couldn't agree more. It is entertainment and you're spot on. When I turn on a tennis tournament or when I look through a draw, yep, we know we're going to have Federer at one end from a seeding point of view, Nadal at the other. We know Djokovic and Murray will be around the mark. But I want to know, I want to have a look at Nick Kyrgios's draw. I want to see what his path through might be because he is entertaining. And 100%. sport is an entertainment option for us to watch on TV. It's that or whatever is on the other station. So, look, I'm a fan. And when he finally gets there, and I think he will because, as we said, he's got the talent. All he needs is a little bit of luck. And perhaps maybe to change a few things off court. Well, the other conversation around Nick is, of course, the coach. He hasn't had one for a very long time. Did you have a coach with you?
Yeah, I mean, I always had a coach, and I think it's hard to do all the little things without one. You know, they take the emotion out of it sometimes. They pick up the little things that you sort of can't emotionally get away from. But I think the other thing is you've got to be ready then to accept what someone else is telling you as well. And so until Nick is ready to hear that outside voice, on a regular basis and trust that person, there's no point bringing someone in.
And that's okay. That's his decision. No, you know, it's his career. It's his decision. Very quickly, what about Bernard Tomic? He's just recently won was it a Challenger tournament?
No, ATP 250 event in Chengdu in China. So,
because he had different to Nick or, you know, very much in the public eye, it's the same thing because they're both bad boys of tennis.
Yeah, but two very, very different people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and very different scenarios. So, I think people forget Bernard Tomic's 25 years old.
It feels like he's been around for a very long time.
And he has. This is the thing. But at 25, so he should be starting to play his best tennis in the next couple of years. I think the thing is, same thing, he hasn't dealt with the pressure and he's only known tennis, you know, brought up with his dad coaching him and no real social upbringing, I'd say.
Yeah.
Where tennis has been all he's known and all he's done. I think he just got a little bit burnt out and, in the nicest way, I don't think he knows how to express how he feels about things. And I think he then says things and probably doesn't get him out the way he wants to and then ends up looking a bit stupid.
Well, he did that Sunday night interview with Channel 7, which I think pushed a lot of people onto the other side of the fence.
I mean, if you're gonna do that and prepare to open up, I think you've got to open up properly.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, half-bake that, to be honest. But I think, you know, I think now that he's starting to play better and he's going to be main draw at the Australian Open, and the same thing. All of a sudden, it's going to come around and now he's won a tournament and we're going to start writing about him again and speaking about him again. Yeah, it's hard because that's the business that it is. Like we said, it is entertainment.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think maybe let's just let him play tennis and not worry about what car he's driving just for a little bit. And just let him focus on maybe winning some tennis matches and... Who knows? Who knows if we just let these guys go about it? Who actually knows how good they could be?
Everybody loves a winner.
That's so true.
You're one of the big headlines of your career. Your career was the serve. The 263 was 263.
Yeah,
263 Ks now, the fastest ever serve recorded in a tennis game. Now, firstly, do you remember the serve?
I do. I was playing in Korea. It was after I had a year off and went and played footy, came back to tennis the next year and I was carrying a few extra kilos, which helped, I guess, a bit of the power stakes.
Yeah.
I lost the match. I remember, so that was, there's videos out there. None of the videos on, someone started filming after I broke the record. Yeah. There's no video of it. But yeah, I mean, I've always had a big serve and I've served, you know, a bunch close up around that, you know, other weeks, but you know, it's something I had to build my game around.
Do you remember the feeling of that particular serve? Was there, you know, did you think, wow, I've hit this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever I was serving at my best, like it was just easy power. Like it was easy to generate and, you know, conditions make a big difference and the balls and, I mean, when you're serving that big, it feels great. It's like when you do anything, like, you know, I play a lot of golf now. Yeah, and when you hit one just sweet, it feels great. Or if you're kicking a footy around, you catch one nice. Like, you just know that it's feeling nice.
I can't kick over a jam, Tim, mate. I've never kicked it well. did the serve come back?
No.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. You lost the match, Sam. I'm just saying.
A lot of other ones did. The problem is, it has to go into count which that one did, but obviously throughout the course of my career, not enough went in. That was the problem.
Well, the Jeff Thompson theory, where he reckons that back in his day and at his prime, when there was no speed gun, he was bowling, you know, well quicker than 160 Ks and the likes of Akhtar and Lee. In your practice sessions, do you reckon you ever got up around that range?
No, because I reckon just the adrenaline and just, I don't think I ever in practice would. If I did that in practice, my shoulder would come off. I'll tell you, my arm would be halfway down the other end of the court.
Are you carrying anything off the back of your career? Any lingering injuries?
Plenty. Didn't you see me walk in? I can barely walk. I've had a knee done. I've had both shoulders cleaned out. I've my foot surgery.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So well enough, obviously, to get around 7 rounds of golf in 7 days?
Yeah, just with a little limp, that's all.
Oh, so there is some lingering effects of your career?
There is, and as we spoke, I haven't looked after myself as well as I could have this year, so once I start doing a little bit more of all the things that I should do, which I'm being encouraged to by my partner.
Yep.
She just, you know, throws a little nudge in there occasionally.
Oh, really?
And I sort of
bit of fat shaming going on in the grub house.
Tell her to get off my back because I've, you know, had to for so long keep it in check. But I think it's just, you know, it's time to sort of just start to get the body a little bit better than this. Right.
Now, we were talking about Grand Slams and your run you went on at Wimbledon. Has there ever been a moment when you've been out on the court during your career and the bloke on the other side of the net and you've just thought, different level, I can't compete?
Yeah. I mean, I played Rafa at the French. That was probably the one that stands out.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd been in Asia. I'd sort of been struggling. I had foot surgery at the end of 2015. It was mid 2016. I'd sort of been struggling to get myself going after my foot surgery and, turned up at the French Open, had been played some challenges in Asia, trying to sort of keep my rank. I wanted to play Olympics that year. And was chasing points and got a bit of a bad neck and ended up pulling out of the last 2 weeks in Asia and turned up the French really underdone.
Mm.
And when you're really underdone going into a Grand Slam, especially the French Open, you don't want to see Rafael Nadal pop up in your section of the draw. I was just trying not to embarrass myself, which I didn't do a very good job of. I think you find on YouTube, there's a video of him hitting between the legs winners and, just to make me feel even better.
Right.
I mean, it was an experience. I played him. People say, have you played the top guys? Like, yeah, I played it. How'd you go? Yeah, not good. Thanks.
Not good. There's plenty of tennis players in that. But who is, I mean, we know Roger's got the most Grand Slams in the men's side of things at the moment. Will Rafa catch him?
I don't know. I think it depends on his body. I think that's probably one of the reasons why Federer's still playing. I think he's sort of got one eye on the rearview mirror and hoping, you know, he'd love to retire and know that no one can ever catch him. I don't know if anyone will ever be as dominant as sort of the guys in this era have been. I think the one they've got to worry about is Novak.
Really?
Just the way he played at Wimbledon and the US Open. If Roger is slowing down, which we've said it before, but he wasn't 37 then.
Yeah.
And depending on Rafa's body, you got to think Rafa's going to win another one or two Frenches if his body stays all right, plus whatever else he can pick up. But, I mean, Novak was pretty dominant those last couple of slams, Wimbledon and the US Open.
Mm.
If he's back, he went on a run there for a couple of years where he just was tearing it up. So if he gets back to that sort of form, you've got to watch out.
What's the biggest misconception from the public about tennis? You know, we know you've spoken about how we probably need to just be or temper our expectations around the Aussie players and the likelihood of them winning a slam or when they do lose, just adjusting our reactions to that. But what's the biggest misconception or misunderstanding that people don't realise about life as a touring tennis pro?
I think the pressure that it is to win week in, week out. And then I think from an Australian point of view, we see the Australian Open and we see people turn up and it's $50,000 Australian to reach the first round of the main draw, and people go, well, tennis players, they make 50. Why is he making $50,000? Okay, you've done a lot of work to get that point. You're the top 100 best players in the whole world, where if you're in any profession in the world, in the 100 best of that, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
But I think also, you don't just turn up at the Australian Open and take $50,000 home with you.
Yeah.
You know, you turn up with your coach, who you pay their flights and hotel and salary, and you turn up with, you know, pay your hotel and your flights and your food, and you pay tax. People forget we pay tax.
Roger doesn't. He's in Switzerland. They don't have tax, do
they? Yeah, look, I never had that. But no, I mean, I think it's just that. You know, I think, and it'll happen again in January, and there'll be all this talk about what the Australian Open prize money is, and people will be blowing up. But then I think, you know, I love my Aussie rules footy. You know, this guys made this per game.
Yeah.
Every week of the year playing Aussie rules footy, and they don't leave home. It's a long way for the footballers to go over to Perth.
But petrol's very expensive in Sydney, Sam.
Yeah, but you got to fly to Perth. Fancy having to fly to Perth twice a year. No, it's I love my footy, so don't get me wrong, I love it. But I think it's just, yeah, a couple of little things that people sort of miss.
Yeah. This has been, and if you haven't already done so, by the time you listen to this, make sure you check out the episode of the Rush Hour with MG that Sam co-hosted. But the big, one of the big stories out of tennis of late was Serena Williams. Put all the political, and I know people might be listening to this saying, you have to take all that into consideration. I want to put all of the political and the feminism and everything else and the cartoons and all that aside for the moment. I want to talk about the tennis incident on court in that US Open final. Did the umpire, did the chair umpire do the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, the chair umpire, he followed the rules. 100%, and he's known to do it, and he's known as a chair umpire that follows the rule book strictly. He has a history. At the French Open this year, he gave both Novak Djokovic and Cecinato in the same match a code violation to each player for coaching. So this is an umpire that has a history of doing this. I've been given code violations for coaching. I think the fact was, at the time, Serena took it personally, that she was cheating, as she, not a cheater, you know, this sort of thing. I think generally as a player, when that happens, you sort of say, okay, like, I've got a code and I've had a point penalty in my life. So I've done something and then I've done something again and I've got a point penalty. So Serena gets a code for coaching, which has happened to probably 75% of players on tour, I would say. Then she gets a point penalty for breaking a racket. Once you have a point penalty, you're on notice. So you know that the codes go warning, point penalty, game, until they deem it's a default. Very rarely does it get multiple games. If you have a game penalty, then you're getting defaulted if you do you're silly enough to do something for a fourth time. But I think once you have a point penalty, you're on notice. You have a point penalty, you sort of go, you know what, like, maybe I just have to pull my head in slightly here.
She went the other way,
and this is the thing though, I mean, people think that she got a game penalty for you know, calling the umpire a thief for taking points, but you're basically telling the umpire he's cheating. She didn't get a game penalty for that. She got a game penalty because it was her third code violation. Right. So I think that's what gets missed a little bit.
Yeah.
I had the same thing happen to me at a tournament last year playing Brian Klein, used to play for Australia, plays for Great Britain, had two codes, was 5-3 in the second. I think I was up a set in 5-3. And he looked straight at the umpire and said, you idiot. Called the umpire an idiot because of an argument they'd had previously, and game penalty straight away. So it's not the first time this has ever happened.
Yeah.
And I think it just gets missed and gets muddled with some of the other stuff that you mentioned.
Yeah.
But from a purely tennis point of view, I just don't think she was handling the pressure that well. And she's trying to break that Margaret Court's record.
Yeah.
And same thing, she's pushing to the end of her career. She's getting older and there's no denying that. And she's had that break and came back unbelievably from having a baby. And you know, everything she's gone through her career, I mean, full respect, like she's the greatest athlete of all time, arguably.
Yeah.
In men's, women's, any sport.
Absolutely in the conversation.
So it's not taking any 100%. Of that away.
No.
But it's just saying, on this moment, I think if she looked back, maybe not in the public, but I think she would look back and probably regret it a little bit.
Yeah. I think, to let in all that outside noise for a moment on the conversation, you've broken down the tennis aspect of it perfectly. To bring in all the outside noise for a moment, I think the way that all these outside issues and other issues are being brought to the fore now is fantastic. And that coupled with the Colin Kaepernick Nike advertisement was another big statement that had just been made not long before that final. Serena's obviously a fantastic ambassador for Nike as well. So she got swept up in that. And I think perhaps all of that compounded with what was going on the tennis court, it just led to the perfect storm. And what happened. But it's, you know, I just hope that, as you say, her legacy will be as the greatest female tennis player ever, arguably the greatest tennis player ever, and certainly in the conversation for one of the greatest athletes we've ever seen. So I hope she's coming out for the Australian Open.
Yeah, she'll be out here. So it's going to be interesting because I think the other thing is, though, from the official's point of view, it's they start to worry about who's putting their hand up to do her matches now a little bit too.
Do they talk about that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, you certainly see certain umpires get on certain players' matches because they know how they deal with them. We saw it with Nick at the US Open,
yeah,
where the umpire overstepped the mark and didn't umpire a match for the rest of the tournament, who's one of the top umpires. So, yeah, I mean, if you're Carlos Ramos, I don't think you're putting your hand up to do Serena's matches straight away.
All right, Oz Open, we are. It's beginning of October when we're having this conversation. Australian Open kicks off middle of January?
Yeah, middle of January. Lead-up tournaments will start, I think, just before the new year.
Make a prediction now for us. I want you to give me your tip for the men's, the women's, and a roughie in both.
Novak Djokovic. I just think the way he played the last two slams, he's had a lot of success down here before. The women's is so hard to pick because it's been so open for the last 2 years. You can just throw a blanket over them.
Well, give us, okay, if you can't give us a tip, then give us somebody who you think might, not surprise, but be one of those outside winners.
Well, honestly, it's probably not outside, but like Naomi Osaka, she's like a young version of Serena Williams. So if she gets it together on a regular basis, like she did at the US Open, she'd won only one match between Wimbledon and the US Open and then comes out and wins the US Open.
Yeah.
So if she can get another good off season again, like no one's going to want to play her.
It'll be interesting to see how she handles the spotlight. Because she got through that US Open, she won the US Open. Of course, the spotlight came by the time the final rolled around, but now it will follow her in the lead up to tournaments as well.
Yeah, it will. But in the US this year, she won the two biggest. She won Indian Wells, which is the biggest tournament outside of the Grand Slams, and she won the US Open. So she's won the two biggest tournaments in the US in the same year. So it's a pretty good effort.
Yeah.
Ruffies, Nick Kyrgios, but I just don't know. I say all this stuff, but if you have to pick a roughie, it has to be Nick because he's the guy that's beaten all the best players.
Yeah.
That's the problem, though.
Don't worry. I'll be throwing my $10 on Nick again at the start of the
tournament. It's the problem. I'd say all this stuff and then I'd just get a little bit of fuel and throw it straight on the fire. Because we all know how good he is.
Yeah. Yeah. And is there any chance, we know you're going to be part of the nine coverage, but is there any chance you could pull on or pick up the racket?
No.
And just in the doubles?
No, I don't think so, mate. I'm done. I've got to.
What if Leighton picked up the phone?
Oh, mate, he will. That's what. if you listen to the episode from today, mate, you can hear it in his voice already.
What, Leighton's 36 now, 37?
Yeah, but Leighton's a lot lighter than I am.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
true.
Throw a little 25 kilo plate on his back and then see how he goes.
Well, Sam Groth, this has been a fantastic chat. You did an outstanding job co-hosting on the Rush Hour without MG today. And as I said, if you're listening to this, this is a bloke who you should be keeping an eye out for in the media space because he's hung up the racket now. And maybe keep an eye out for him on the golf course as well because that's the other place you're most likely to see him.
Yeah, probably on your fairway.
Yeah.